The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, Ed Miliband draws level with David Cameron in the popularity polls as fortunes appear to be changing for the Labour leader only recently written off as a geek. Meanwhile, in Downing Street, David Cameron has lost his blue sky thinker, Steve Hilton, but the arresting ideas keep on coming. A leaked Tory report calls for a bonfire of workers' rights to ease unemployment. Also, the enduring appeal of an EU referendum. Why are Labour now joining the Tories in flirting with an in-out vote? And in a week of intemperate language, Vince Cable gets called a socialist, Nick Clegg a communist, and Cameron loses his rag with Mr. Ed Balls again.
And with innovative ways of using our hard-won credibility, which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me.
Here to digest all of this, we have columnists Zoe Williams and Gabby Hinsliff, as well as the Observer's Nick Cohen. A warm welcome to you all. Now, if you're a reader of much of the British press, you might have been forgiven for thinking that Ed Miliband is an awkward policy wonk who somehow knifed his brother in the back to take control of his party, but had no idea of what he wanted to do with it after that, and ultimately had no chance whatsoever of becoming Prime Minister. But what a difference a few months can make. Not only is Labour riding high in the polls, but the man at the helm is giving David Cameron a regular duffing up in the Commons and is now joint favourite with some bookmakers to win the next election. I asked the Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter what had changed.
He's got much better, yes, there's no question about it. And he's grown in confidence, partly because I think he's got better scriptwriters. The jokes tend to be a little bit better. He had a pretty rough one about Cameron being chillaxing today, you know, the notion that he's got plenty of time left for computer games, glasses of wine and so forth. Also, the fact that the polls are going in his direction, it's a virtuous circle as far as Labour's concerned, in that the more confidence you get, the better you appear in public, the higher your poll ratings go and the more confident you get. So for the Tories, they've always thought, well, whatever goes wrong, however bad the state of the economy is, however many cuts there are, however resentful people feel about what we're doing to them, at least we know that they'll never vote for Ed Miliband as Prime Minister. And I think what's happened with the recent batch of polls, and of course the earlier this month, the local government elections, which are very bad indeed for the Tories, considerably worse than they feared, they always thought that this was their consolation. Ed Miliband would never be Prime Minister, but when it came to it, in the polling booth, voters would say, oh, no, we can't vote for that Wallace lookalike from Wallace and Gromit, so we're going to vote the Tory instead. Well, you know, the polls seem to imply that may not be the case anymore, and of course they're a little bit scared.
Well, Nick, on occasion you've been fairer than some columnists to Ed Miliband and said give Ed a chance, I think, once or twice. Suddenly it seems lots of other people are doing the same thing. What do you think is going on?
Well, I've always been critical of this belief among journalists, myself included, that we can see the future, that we're, like Gypsy Rose at the end of Southend Pier and can tell fortunes. And it seemed to me when Ed Miliband was elected that he's got some things going for him, and they have got stronger. I mean, first of all, there is a united centre-left in England and Wales, not Scotland. Pretty much everyone who regards themselves centre-left is behind the Labour Party. That's quite important. It hasn't existed for a long time. And the second thing is that we are in a rolling economic crisis with no end to it in sight. Now, you would expect whatever personal qualities, and I agree with what Simon Hoggart said, you know, he was very unsure when he started leading and he's growing in confidence now. You wouldn't expect to have the kind of politics we had for the previous 30 years where a party gets in with a dominating figure and is there for just about ever. You would expect shifts between left and right. You know, you'd expect it to be far more volatile. And given the failure of the government economic policy, not all its fault, but a lot of it its fault, you know, it's not so surprising that people are turning to Labour.
So we've got to kind of keep it in perspective, haven't we? I mean, maybe outside of The Guardian, people have it very much in perspective. After all, he's only the least unpopular or joint least unpopular leader at the moment?
Well, I think a couple of things. Firstly, the relationship between how somebody performs in PMQs and how that they do in the polls, I think, are so different as to be almost antithetical. And the fact that they coincide at this particular moment is pure coincidence. Well, you know, it's everybody always goes, oh, well, they've grown in confidence. William Hague was brilliant at the dispatch box. You often don't play well. That kind of smart ass, oh, ha, 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 I just got you in your Achilles heel, in your chillaxing. That smart-ass thing doesn't play well when you're trying to get people to vote for you because the actual atmosphere is very different. You know, on the one hand, when politicians talk to voters, they're really playing up their sincerity. And when they're talking to one another, they're really playing up their kind of Yabu sucks sixth form debating skill. And the two things are completely different. So I've never thought that the reason for his unpopularity in the polls was because he wasn't good enough in PMQs. I do think that that people are looking at him as the least of two evils at the moment. And I would be surprised if things didn't change a little bit between now and 2015. I mean, but then, you know, I know journalists can't see the future, but a lot of people don't think the government's going to last till 2015. And part of kind of lining up behind Miliband is about... It's a kind of contingency planning, just as they're contingency planning for Greece leaving the euro, we're contingency planning for the coalition breaking up.
What do you think in terms of... I mean, he's obviously not been a very energetic leader of the Labour Party. We all get many more press releases from, say, Ed Balls than we do from Ed Miliband and the leadership itself. And he's made a few big calls, I'd say, you know, on responsible capitalism.
That's a big one, yeah.
And, do you think News International and one or two other things, do you think that those are paying off for him, like...
I don't think it was about that. I think there are several times when he's managed to sort of, the big thing that you have to do as leader of opposition is manage to actually catch people's attention. I mean, that's the hardest thing because, you know, you're very easily ignored. It's much more exciting to talk about what the government's doing. So he has a couple of times sort of captured people's imagination. And one of those times was in coming out so strongly and so early in attacking Rupert Murdoch. But that's the kind of thing that is very, very, very important to journalists, but doesn't move a huge amount of votes. I think the difference now is that what's coming to him now is all coming because of people's feelings about the economy. And that actually is something that you do vote on. That is something that moves elections. So I think he's finally getting some traction on an issue that matters. And I think it's weird the way, I mean, what people always said about Ed was, you know, he's too geeky, he's too nerdy, he's a loser, he's kind of, there's that whole kind of over-intellectualised, you know, airy-fairy air about him. Actually, I think what's changed is that somehow feels right for the times. You know, we have the same feeling that I think I remember from the summer of 2008, you know, the credit crunch was just starting, and you can feel this awful sense of apprehension that something big is unfolding that we can't stop, that is beyond our control, and that there, you know, the next few months look very, very scary indeed. And during that period, Gordon Brown came to feel, for all his faults, really quite a reassuring figure. You felt at least he had a plan, at least he felt that he knew what to do about it, whereas the Tories were slightly running around like rabbits in headlights. And you get that feeling again that now is not a bad time to be a rather intense, rather earnest, rather sort of technocratic person who knows what happens inside the Treasury.
Although, wouldn't you say there's a limit to that, Nick, in that Gordon Brown could jet off to Washington and announce an emergency restructuring plan for the banks or whatever? Ed Miliband at the moment is saying we need something different, which is responsible capitalism. He's not brilliant at bringing it to life in terms of it would mean for bread and butter issues.
Well, he doesn't. When he made that speech, which I sort of agreed with, I think I agreed with it, there were no examples whatsoever, which was quite odd. And it would have to mean bank reform, serious bank reform, which is crying to high heaven to happen. But Ed Balls, you look at him and you look at his record on the banks, you know, not so different from George Osborne. And you do wonder if Miliband wants to, if Balls would deliver it. But, I mean, Gabby's point is surely the essential one. The big fact is that people's incomes are falling. Unemployment may not have gone through the roof. Or you look at the number of people in part-time work who want full-time work and what have you. It's still pretty grim. And there's no sign of the euro crisis ending. And in those circumstances, you look at Hollande's election in France. You know, Hollande was a rather boring socialist apparatchik. I mean, everyone thought his ex-wife was the one who could be president, but he won. And you can see up at Miliband, but you know, perhaps I'm being prejudiced, perhaps it's a sign of getting old when leaders are younger than you. You do think that the Labour, I do think from Labour point of view, they can't be complacent.
Well, that's, yeah. I mean,
they've really got to do a lot more and try a lot
harder. It's only the start. This is only getting people to look at you and then see what you think. And that's what you've seen, you know, everyone starting to run the rule over him. It's not necessarily the same as, you know, Miliband further sweeping the nation.
And in a way, that's where I kind of disagree, because I think that is problematic. It's great for Ed Miliband if everybody feels the economic crisis in their pocket, because then they stop worrying about whether he looks like Wallace or Gromit, whichever one it is, and then they start voting for the person with policies. But it's not great for him when there's Armageddon approaching, because he does look quite green, and maybe I'm getting old as well, but he does not look like somebody who knows. He's not Gordon Brown.
That's the scary thing, is I look at all three of them.
Yeah, well, sure,
and think,
yeah,
and across Europe more widely, and think, where's the grown-ups?
Yeah, it's very thin. It's very thin. But, I mean, exactly as you wish Gordon Brown was kind of at least around, Ed Miliband doesn't fill me with that kind of faith at all.
And, Gabby, can you just we've had a sort of mini Labour reshuffle, haven't we? John Cruddas, a sort of figure on the
King.
On the left, and also Andrew Adonis, Blairite, Liam Byrne moving out. Did it look to you that the overall effect there was a more confident Miliband striking out a bit to the left?
I didn't feel it was a move to the left necessarily, because you have, you know, Cruddas sort of makes people think of that, but actually he's not easy to pigeonhole as being straightforwardly on the left of the Labour Party, and Adonis is very much a counterweight to that. So I didn't feel it was an ideological change. I did feel there was a shift towards getting people back with big and interesting ideas, which is what Cruddas is all about, and sort of bringing more of the talents on board. And you can sense there's a closeness, you know, Tony Blair is clearly anticipating some kind of move back into domestic politics. You know, we wait with bated breath to see what, but a sense of the two old teams kind of coalescing a bit and people kind of clustering around Miliband. There's a sense of seriousness of purpose about it that there wasn't before. But
so
I think
it's
one of those reshuffles that most people, you know, most ordinary people would think, you know, somebody I've never heard of just replaced somebody I've never heard of.
Yeah.
But why do you think Liam Byrne was moved aside?
I think because Liam had put an awful lot of backs up within the party. I think also because you're into the next stage of the policy review now, which is not so much about coming up with the detailed policy, which is something that Cruddas himself would say he's not particularly good at. It's a salesman job almost now, the policy review job for the next year or two, because you're starting to think about rolling stuff out, and that wasn't necessarily Liam Byrne's skill, but, you know, they were never, Liam and Ed Miliband were never particularly close.
I suppose at least John Cruddas has got that accent, hasn't he? I mean, if he's explaining these policies on TV, it's better to have someone who doesn't sound like they've done PPE, Nick.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. John isn't a bog-standard lefty by any means. Very free-thinking and very close to working-class concerns. And remember, you know,
quite right-wing on the social stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, one reason why Labour did so disastrously at last election was working-class voters just didn't want anything to do with it. It's something that, you know, isn't talked about enough, is how Labour can reconnect with the working class. And John would be very good at that. I mean, I do wonder how much influence these gurus have. You know, if you are the shadow transport minister or whatever, if John Cruddas and Andrew Adonis or whoever tells you we've got to do this, say, no, it's my brief, I can do what I want. You know, it's we kind of blown. Something else that's interesting about them is they're both quite likeable, decent people. You know, they're not part of, you know, if you have them at the top of a party, you're not going to get a load of backstabbing breaking out. They're they're good people to have on an opposition team where, you know, you go back a few years, Labour Party was, you know, it was like the Borshas. It was just, you didn't want to be involved with it.
Full of snakes.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. But it means, doesn't it, Zoe, that, like, he may have got, like, decent people and a united centre-left, as John's saying. You've still got, though, Ed Bald, which is someone that people regard as divisive. And
who
someone
could start a fight in an empty room.
I know. Well, yeah, he could start a fight in an empty room, but I think it is quite an interest. It's quite interesting how this kind of vacuum of hostility is opening up round Ed Bald's, which is going to eventually make him look a bit silly, don't you reckon?
What, he'd be briefing when no one's briefing against
him? Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's very much, I think many people have the sense with Ed Bald's that he's still operating in a very early noughties way. So, you know,
I don't think he can help himself.
He just can't help himself.
The interesting question of the next year is going to be, if Labour's poll lead stays, you know, if they maintain the advantage they've got, who's going to take the credit for that? Is Ed Miliband going to take the credit for it, or is Ed Balls going to want to take the credit for it and want to argue that essentially, you know, if it's, if people's minds are changing on Labour's handling of the economy, well, you know, who gets credit for that?
Well, I mean, he has made, and made some risk to himself, hasn't he, Gabby? Some pretty difficult calls about, you know, how hard to go on. It has to be a growth-first strategy, and the deficit's the second thing. And he's ferociously energetic.
And he clearly feels like Cassandra. You know, a year ago, people were laughing at his stuff. And, you know, the government were lecturing him very solemnly on how tremendously wasteful, you know, how we would all go to hell in a handcart if we followed what he was suggesting. And now government's casting around for, you know...
And he deserves some credit for that, Gabby. I'm not here to be his PR, but he does deserve some credit for that. Because he would have been a ridiculous figure if he got it wrong, but he followed.
He would have been finished. Yeah. I mean, we don't know yet that he's got it right. Who knows?
I know, but to be fair,
it'll be 2 or 3 years before we know who, if anybody, got it right.
Yeah, but this argument between, you know, the kind of Keynesian Paul Krugman model and the austerity model, it's happening all around the world. Yeah. I don't think you can look at Ed Balls and go, wow, he's really onto something. I mean,
I'm not suggesting that, you know, he invented somehow single-handedly the answer to the crisis. But there are two sides. There are, classically in economics, two approaches to this kind of crisis. Government is on one, he's on the other. You know,
yeah, but that's the only side he could have been on.
The right side of that argument in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's literally the only side he could have been
on.
He couldn't have been the other austerity party.
It's not literally the only side. There's an entire party on the other side. So it's not as if it's completely obvious that that's where you had to be. And I think... there was a point, certainly, last year where there was a very, you know, live internal debate within the Labour Party about whether to stick with that kind of Keynesian Plan B approach, or whether Labour should just say, look, we got it wrong, we spent too much, we touched, you know, we did...
in the black
Labour. And apologised more for what he had done in government.
I mean, it's certainly true that they have been noisier on Keynesianism and quieter. There have been kind of crescendos.
So yeah, I mean, but also, if you just divide it into Keynesians v. Conservatives, you miss something else. So this is, whatever happens, there is going to have to be some quite radical restructuring. And that's why In the Black Labour were quite interesting, because they were they were talking about, look, the greatest Labour government was 1994-1995 Labour government, absolute, you know, operating in absolute austerity, bombed-out country. You can still do things if you start thinking like that. And that's what worries me about Ed Balls to an extent. I mean, that and his conservatism on the banks is that by the time of next election, first of all, to win the election, you're going to have to start saying, well, things are going to be very, very different. You can't go back to the model of the first decade of the century. And second, what if they win? You know, what are they going to do? With no money, yes.
Well, it's interesting, because if Ed Miliband is slightly hemmed in by Ed Balls in terms of what he might want to do on economic policy, one area where you'd think he'd have a relatively free hand, Gabby, is on foreign policy and Europe. But he's been making some interesting noises there as well.
Yes, we're suddenly here. I mean, it's all sort of slightly teasing at the moment rather than committed, but there have started to be a lot of hints, and Fred Ed Ball started it, that Labour might be considering a referendum on Europe, which would presumably be an in-out, once and for all, do you want to be part of it or don't you, referendum. And it's purely mischievous in some ways. I mean, it's purely about winding the Tories up and putting them, Cameron, in a position where the Labour Party sounds like it's offering something that many, many Tories would, you know, give their eye teeth for. And it keeps Europe in the headlines, and it keeps the government at loggerheads and all the rest of it. So I think there is a huge amount of mischievous positioning in this. But that said, there are a number of people in the cabinet who are increasingly attracted to the idea. I mean, why not, if you're a pro-European and you believe you could make the case, why not make the case and then use that to say, right, you know, once and for all, we've said where we stand, now can we just shut up? Well, could we just stop moaning and get on with being good Europeans? And if you're, you know, if you're John Cruddas, you think that it's entirely right to give public a say in what government does, and you can't just have elites deciding what we're going to do and not bothering to consult the public in case they give the wrong answer.
But
you can see there's a mixture, I think, of real politics in this and really virtual politics, you know, just a bit of positioning to wind up the other side.
isn't the difficulty with it, Nick, that we don't really know where Europe will be in a month's time, never mind 3 years' time. So it's kind of flirting
I was speaking to a diplomat last week, and he gave a long talk about Europe. I said, I often forget how foreign policy is just sitting there in the Foreign Office waiting to see what the bloody hell's going to happen next. He said, that's not just some of foreign policy, that's all of foreign policy. You know, it's... there's also
that's reassuring.
Yeah, well, I mean, quite. I won't even try to predict where Europe's going to be in 3 months' time. There's also this problem, which I think this point Gabby made in the piece in The Guardian the other day, that what happens if you call a referendum on Europe and your government's got to take a stand, and the government says we stay in, the public says no. What do you do next? Do you resign? I mean, do you say how can we take us out of Europe when I've campaigned? We think it's wrong. I mean, it just strikes
me. It has to be, but a referendum has to be binding on government, or there's no point in having it, really. I am pro-European. If we had a referendum tomorrow, I would have absolutely no hesitation about voting to stay in Europe. Quite why I would do so
is another question. And becoming harder by the day.
I know, but it's just an instinctive thing. And then you think, I'd quite like some more evidence on which to base that decision, please.
Do you think we can assume it would go the way that all the grown-ups, sorry, self-appointed grown-ups, would want it to go at the moment? Or do you think Europe's changing so fast that, knows
what... I can't possibly predict what will happen with Europe or what anybody will think about Europe. Yeah. It's just completely shifting sands, isn't it? Because you don't even know what you'd be voting for. You don't even... Are you voting to be in it to the extent that we're in it now? Are you voting to join their doomed currency? Are you voting to clear up the mess of their currency? What would you actually be voting for if you wanted to... with a yes vote?
And also, if you vote no, you can't, to a certain extent... It's not like if we vote no, oh, right, we're excluded from the Europe, from the euro crisis now, then. It's fine. You know, the whole of Europe can go up in flames and we won't notice. That's not how it would work. We're still exposed massively through British banks.
Exactly. It's European a bit like voting against climate change.
Do you think, Gabby, that it does suggest a certain lack of seriousness? You know, they're still thinking more about how to bring the Tories down a notch or two than about what they'd actually do in power. Because you can imagine this would be a great millstone around their necks, can't you?
Well, there's only so far you can go with that. There's only so far you can go with sort of hinting at it and teasing the public about it before you have to show the colour of your money, so to speak. And at that point, you know, if you've led people up the garden path and then you turn around and say, oh, no, we're not going to have one, actually, you look rather
silly. I think this is also classic. This is classic the way Ed Balls operates, is that he's constantly thinking, how will this play politically? How will that...
Yeah,
rebound on this, and it's very strategic, and it's very kind of chessy, but it's not very helpful.
It would be far better.
How do I screw the opposition?
Yeah,
and how do I,
how do I make a better world?
It'd be far better to say, look, Labour Party, or indeed Cameron said, we will keep all options open. Anything could happen, but we are not committed to any model from the last 5 years or the last 30 years of what our relations would be. And it would seem far more grown-ups to do that than it does, though. It is sort of...
Well, what I do think is if anyone's going to play this game, because government is obviously going to... You know, it's possible that it will simply be resolved by Cameron being forced into promising one. But anybody who cares about a yes vote should put a bit more thought into how you would obtain one, because it's been a long time since anyone's made...
It's very interesting, Gabby, our attitudes to Europe. If you look at when we joined, Europe was prosperity, it was the future, it was cars at work, it was beautiful Swedish furniture, cafes. And now there's sort of this feeling, not we're in a particularly better position, of Europe looking tired and with no political leadership and just... And unable to sort out its own problems.
It looks really, really bloody serious, doesn't it, now? And the kind of losses incurred by the possible Greek exit are so vast that...
Almost unimaginable.
It's unimaginable. So you look at it and think, you can't even give it a kind of anthropomorphic form. You can't even say it looks like this or it looks like that. It just looks like a huge earthquake about to happen.
Well, let's not depress ourselves.
I'm quite cheerful.
Let's go back to the political playbook stuff. I mean, this is obviously one of several... cracks in the coalition which the Labour Party is trying to inflame, but there are other ones too. A certain Tory donor has said recently that Nick Clegg is always threatening, and I quote, to go nuclear and dissolve the whole thing if he doesn't get his way with this or that. Now, that donor is Adrian Beecroft, who's the author of a now leaked report this week that's causing ructions yet again in the coalition. One of Beecroft's most controversial ideas was to make sacking workers easier in order to make hiring them more attractive in the first place. It was a line that Ed Miliband quoted with some glee at PMQs.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister says he's consulting on the proposal. This is what the author of the proposal, Mr. Beecroft, said, and I quote, "Some people will be dismissed simply because their employer doesn't like them. While this is sad, I believe it is a price worth paying." Mr. Speaker, that's what they used to say about unemployment. Is he really telling us that with record numbers out of work, sacking people for no good reason is a price worth paying?
Well, he might, while he's on his feet, welcome the fact that unemployment is falling. Inflation is falling. And this government has cut the deficit by 25%. But let me actually explain to him what the government and what the business secretary are actually doing. We are cutting regulation by £3 billion. We are scrapping 1,500 regulations. We are looking at introducing fees for employment tribunals. We are taking all of these steps, which have led to the greatest number of small business startups last year in the country's history. Of course, he cannot support any changes to employment regulation because he's in the pocket of the trade unions.
So he, sad to use a word of the moment, sad to say it, but I think a lot of the Conservative Party just sincerely believes this, don't they? You make it cheaper to
sack people,
to hire people, and then you fire.
What's really interesting is that the whole language has moved away from seeing workers as assets. So everything from Steve Hilton's idea of getting rid of maternity leave to this idea of being able to sack people, it all moves away from the idea that your workers might be in any way valuable to you. And the Tories kind of present that as though that's obvious. Obviously, business people are pitted against their employees. But actually, you know, the view from the ground would be that employees aren't interchangeable. And when you get one that you like and is good, you want to keep them. So this is really no better a reflection of business than any other kind of rhetorical. But what they do is they conjure up the kind of business that they want for their political point, and then they make the point. But it doesn't actually, you know, Beecroft's report is stupid. Sorry.
It seems to me that they could make they can make their dry as dust economic argument about supply and demand, make it cheaper to hire workers and then people will hire more of them. But they cannot, Nick, turn that into any sort of political argument. So when Vince Cable says it's dead, it probably is dead, isn't it?
This report is a classic example of why people at the top of hierarchies, people at the top of businesses, why you should never let them out of the house alone. There's not a single piece of research in it. There's not
like
a single reference
to
any of the studies. Helen Lewis, I think, is on the New Statesman, went through it and said it mentions I and me about 20 times, never uses the word research, never, you know. I mean, this is just a golf club bore, being well-oiled on the G&Ts and allowed to rant.
What I find annoying about it, I mean, is personally, I don't think it is fear of employment law that is stopping firms expanding at the moment. It is the fact that the economy looks like it might be headed off a cliff. So now is probably not the time to open your new office in Basingstoke. However, with apologies to the people of Basingstoke, but I would like to see some evidence of that, because that's my view. I can't provide hard factual evidence on that one or the other. So it would be quite sensible if government provided some hard factual evidence on that one way or the other, and then we could all kind of know and move on. But that's precisely what Beecroft doesn't do. All it basically tells us is that employers don't like red tape. You know, well, teachers don't like being offsetted. Journalists don't like having sub-editors. My little boy hates being told to go to bed on time. Nobody likes regulation, but it's often for the greater good. And I think it would have been useful if government had taken this opportunity to investigate exactly where. Because it's not that every single piece of legislation ever or every single piece of regulation ever on business or small business is entirely necessary. But, you know, it would be nice if we had some evidence base for deciding which bits are and aren't necessary.
I'll tell you what's sending me off my nut a little bit. I was arguing with Liz Truss last night, who I quite like, the Tory MP for Norfolk, and she said with a straight face, well, we've got a productivity crisis in this country, by which she means GDP, I guess. And she said the reason was that our 15-year-olds weren't doing well enough in their SATs.
We do have a productivity crisis, but that might be for good reason. There was certainly after the crash that employers were hoarding labour. Then rather than fire people, they were putting them on part-time contracts, which obviously was better than sacking them. But I mean, the chronic reason for economic sacking is a lack of demand. Businesses are sitting on billions and billions of cash, and they cannot see investment opportunities in Britain. I mean, and until demand increases, that's going to go on. Yeah. It is interesting. I often think about this with the conservative right, is that they still believe in their utopia. I mean, the left don't. After the 20th century, you know, beyond social democracy, whatever postures people take, there's not really a coherent left-wing programme. The right still believe in a crisis you can get the minimal state, you know, in complete hire and fire, the complete free market. They haven't been disillusioned with that yet, even despite the banking crisis, which you'd have thought might have been a bucket of cold water in some people's faces.
Well, on that note of respect of a sort for the Beecroft report, we'll draw things to a close. My thanks to Zoe Williams, to Gabby Hindliffe and to Nick Cohen. The producer was Phil Nainard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.